Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, got your brains plugged in? You ready to go?
Yes.
We're going to cover a lot of ground tonight, and we're going to throw around big theological terminology. Ooh. Chapter 20 of the book of Numbers is where we'll be starting tonight. Let's begin with a word of prayer, and then we'll jump right into the text. Heavenly Father, we pray that you'll join us here this evening. Open our minds and our hearts as we look into your word. Open your word to us, not just as an intellectual exercise, but as a reality to help us understand the God that we're dealing with. I pray tonight that what we do here in this little church will be glorifying to you, and that it will raise up Christ, and that your people will be nourished and fed and secured in the finished work of Christ. And we pray all this in his precious name. Amen. Oh, wait, I have to tell you a funny story. Jennifer told me today. You know, we have folk over the internet that contribute to GCA, which we're very thankful for. We put a PayPal link on our website a little while back. I originally was not in favor of the idea of a PayPal link on our website. And then there were people overseas who wrote to us and said, but if I can contribute via PayPal, they'll do the conversion rate automatically, and I want to help your church, and so that made sense. And then a couple of people wrote and said, you know, it's just more convenient if I can just hit PayPal and contribute. So I agreed. We've had it for a while. Well, I don't know that much about PayPal overall and how it works. I've used it a couple of times, but Jennifer told me today to point out to the folks on the internet that when you make a payment via PayPal, it asks you whether you are purchasing something or whether you are giving a gift.
It's business or personal.
Business or personal. Mm-hmm. And if you leave it on business, there's a few questions you have to answer. If you leave it on personal, it becomes a gift. And if it's personal, we, the church, don't have to pay the same fee to PayPal that we pay in a business transaction. However, we had someone send some money as a business transaction. And there is a line that they have to fill out that says what they purchased with the money that they sent. And they wrote sheep food.
That's pretty good.
I think that's great. That proves they've been listening. Purchase some sheep food via PayPal. Pretty cool. Chapter 20. We're starting in chapter 20 of the book of Numbers, starting right at verse 1. Then the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed at Kadesh. Now Miriam died there and was buried there. And there was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron. Does this sound familiar yet? Again? This is thematic. We have been working our way verse by verse through the first five books of the Bible, and once you get to Exodus, from that point forward, there is this consistent theme that keeps coming around that the people of Israel, though they see God's nonstop miracles, though they see God's provision over and over again, little things like parting the Red Sea, little things like a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day leading them, little things like water from a rock sufficient for a million people and all their animals. You know, these small indications that God is with them, like bread from heaven every single day. And then every Sabbath day, they don't pick up any bread because there's enough the previous day for 2 days. This is even bread on a timetable. And yet, every time they get the least little bit uncomfortable, every time things get a little difficult for them, comparatively, they immediately start complaining. And since they know that when God gets mad, he does things like burn the outside of the camp, or open up the ground and swallow Korah and his whole family. So they don't want to talk directly against God. So they go to the leadership that God has put in place over them and complain to the leadership. And then God takes it personally again and then says they're complaining against me again. Now, the reason I'm stressing this is that this repetition of this kind of bad behavior and this kind of complaining against Moses is going to help us understand the mindset of Moses when he makes the mistake he's about to make. And Moses is about to make a huge mistake. But he's going to make that mistake because he's just like you and me. He's exactly like us. He's just human. Sometimes we see these characters in the Bible and we have a tendency to put them on pedestals and say, wow, they were really great and wonderful and perfect. All this stuff we read Sunday morning about Paul finally concluding in Romans 7 that what he would do, he doesn't find the strength to do, and the thing he doesn't want to do, that's what he does. Because he's just like us. He's just human. God is dealing with broken people, cracked pots, people like you and I, who though in our minds we delight after the things of God, nevertheless in our bodies there is this law of sin coursing through us. And so we are by nature rebels. And if it weren't for the constraining hand of God, every one of us would shake our fist at God till he gave us exactly what we deserved. And so the children of Israel, one more time, are going to complain. And they're going to complain about the same thing in the exact same place. They're back at Meribah. Now, if that sounds familiar, they've already been here once. In fact, let's go back and look at it. Go back in the book of Exodus. Go back to the book of Exodus. Let's go to chapter 17. And let's start right at the beginning of chapter 17 of Exodus. This is the first time that they came to Meribah. Meribah, by the way, is a name that Moses gives the place. He's going to give it a couple of names that describe what happened to the people while they were there. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Zin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." Do you know what Meribah means? It means quarreling. So he's going to name the place Quarreling, because these people are going to quarrel with him the whole time. They quarrel with Moses and say, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me, and why do you test the Lord?" That's a very interesting phrase he chose to use right there. He said, when you come to me and complain to me, you're testing God because you're implying that God doesn't know that at this moment you're in the desert without water. As if God has no concept that he brought you out of Egypt by this mighty hand and brought you through the Red Sea and drowned all your enemies and then promised to take you to the land that he promised 430 years ago to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He's bringing you back to that very land, and then midway through the trip, God just lost his mind and left you in a place where there was no water. And so he said, when you complain like this, you're testing God, the God who has already provided for you, who has already made promises to you, who has already shown his faithfulness to you, and now you've got the nerve to complain against God. By the way, anybody here in the room guilty? Yeah, yes. Alex is pointing at everyone else. You know, those people. Yeah. We do that so easily. I mean, the people who we're talking about right here had one change of clothing. Now, for 40 years, that clothing doesn't wear out, but it's one pair of clothing, one set of clothes, one pair of shoes. They're not going to wear out, but it's one pair of shoes. One thing to eat, bread from heaven every day. They get bread every day, and it's a perfect nutrition that sustains them for 40 years, but it is all they get. And you've got endless variety of clothes and shoes and things to eat. Alex and I went out to eat before we got here. We had to pick which restaurant first. Then we got to the restaurant and had to pick which food we wanted. And then when they brought my food, It wasn't right. It's true.
And you grumbled.
And I grumbled. And they brought me other food. Yeah, we are so spoiled. We are so ridiculously spoiled. These people were wandering in the desert. We live our lives in air conditioning and central heat. In fact, we are so spoiled that if we feel a little hot or cool, we change the environment of the building we're in to suit us. That's how spoiled we are. Oh, but let something go wrong. Let the least little thing make us the least little bit uncomfortable. We go whining to God. Why, God? Why would you do this? I didn't see this coming, God. I'm supposed to be the one you like. I'm supposed to be the one that everything goes good for. Why would you do this, God? My best life now. I want my best life now. So what I'm saying is I'm kind of empathetic with these people. They were under a much more difficult circumstance than you and I are under. You can see, okay, we're at this place. There's no water. We are thirsty, and oh yeah, it's a desert. I can see why they got like that. The point is, in the gap between Exodus 17 and Numbers 19, they've gone through a tremendous amount of interaction with God, where God has proven time and time and time and time again how faithful He is. He keeps showing them. He keeps correcting them. Sometimes He punishes them. Sometimes He delivers them. He keeps showing them, I'm right there in your midst. After the first time He gave everybody water out of a rock, they should have shut up about the water thing. But they didn't, because human nature is such that as soon as things go bad, we want to find somebody we can point at and say, this is your fault. By the way, most of what happened to them was their fault. But they couldn't wait to point at somebody else and say, this is your fault. You did this to me. So therefore, the people quarreled with Moses. We're back in Exodus 17. Moses said to them, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, why now have you brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? Yes, that was God's master plan. I'm so glad you worked that out for yourself. Now, clearly, they have a promise from God. They have a promise of being taken to the promised land flowing with milk and honey, a promise made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The very fact that God, 400 years after the promise, brought Moses and did deliver them exactly like He said He would. That's a 400-year-old prophecy come to fruition. That should have been enough to make them confidently say, we're going to take that land now. So they grumbled, why'd you take us out of Egypt? Are you just planning to kill us? So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do to these people? A little more and they will stone me. That's an indication of how angry they really were. They wanted to overthrow God's leadership because they were so certain that they were going to suffer. Then the Lord said to Moses, pass before the children, take with you some of the elders of Israel, take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile. Now this should start to resonate with those of you who have been a part of this regular Wednesday night study. What is that staff He's talking about? Whose staff?
Aaron's staff.
It's Aaron's staff. The same staff that's later going to bud, that God is going to say, this is my proof that I have chosen Aaron as my high priest, that I have chosen Levi as the tribe that's going to serve in my tabernacle. So this is the same staff that He used to strike the water of the Nile and turn it into blood. He said, use that staff. This is the same staff that He raised up over His head and the Red Sea parted. This is that staff. He says, take that staff, which we now know is a type of Christ. We see it in its resurrection when it buds and comes to life and then is put in front of the Ark of the Covenant later. So He says, take that staff and then strike the rock, the one with which you struck the Nile, and go, and behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he named the place Massah, which means testing, because he said, why do you test the Lord? And Meribah, which means quarreling, because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel. And because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? So the first time that there's this interaction between Moses and the rod and the rock, he's told to take the rod, which at this point is not yet resurrected. It is a dead stick. It is a stick that does things like bring plagues, turn water into blood, open up the Red Sea. He says, take that stick and strike the rock. And when you strike the rock, living water flows out of it. Well, when we studied this passage all those months ago, we then went to the New Testament and saw all the New Testament parallels where Jesus talked about the living waters that would flow out of those people that belong to him. And everyone who comes to me, living waters will flow out of their belly. The same typology. And so we identified this rock. According to Paul, this rock was Christ. He picks it up in the New Testament and says it plainly, that rock was Christ. Well, they take the rock with them. Now, here's another interesting bit of historical spy work we have to do here. Notice that God did not say, go to Horeb and find a rock. All Israel was in Horeb. He said, go to Horeb and I'll meet you at the rock. What rock? Moses knew which rock. The rock. History tells us that the Israelites were big fans of carrying around things that meant something to them historically. And so most of the rabbis conclude that the rock was Jacob's pillar stone, the rock on which Jacob laid his head and saw the angels ascending and descending on what we call Jacob's ladder, going to heaven, coming back down, because that's the place where Jacob received the Abrahamic promise and the promise of this land and that his people were going to come back. You have to assume that if you're a shepherd who's used to laying your head on various different things at night and various different rocks, and then you lay your head on one rock and you see heaven, you don't leave that rock there. In fact, the original account tells us in Genesis that Jacob changed the name of that rock. Remember what he called it? He called it Bethel, the house of God. You don't name a rock house of God and leave it out there in the middle of nowhere. You take that rock with you. And so the assumption is, among most of the Jewish scholars and Old Testament scholars, that the rock is Jacob's pillar stone, which they still knew where it was and how to find it, where it was identifiable, or that they had taken it with them when the original 12 brothers and all their families came into Egypt. You wouldn't leave an artifact like that behind. You would bring it with you and then take it with you when you were delivered. However it ended up in their midst, it's apparently Jacob's pillar stone, the rock. So now put all these pieces together. Bethel, house of God, rock. Now go take Aaron's rod, use it to strike the rock, and the rock is going to give living water to all God's elect people, Israel. Got the imagery? Mm-hmm. But the water came when the rock was struck. The life flowed from the rock once the rock was struck. Very important type. Now go forward to Numbers. We're back in Numbers 20. The people thus contended, says verse 3, the people thus contended with Moses and spoke, saying, if only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord, we'd be better off dead. Let's think about how those brothers perished for just a moment. Let's see, there was the one where God burned everybody on the outside of the camp. Can you imagine reaching the point where you go, well, that would be better. Just fried out here in the... Or God opens up the earth and an entire family and clan goes straight into hell alive. Wish we had perished like that. It's just how crazy people get when they're suffering a bit. But this is the same people who were in the same situation in the exact same geographical location and God gave them water from a rock. Wouldn't they have been best suited to come back and say, hey, we're out of water and we're at Horeb. I'll bet God's going to give us water. They should have anxiously anticipated God's deliverance. Instead, they said, God, we'd be better off dead. And by the way, that's the tone of voice that the entire group, that's a million people who all use that exact tone. Why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? Isn't that the same question they asked back in Exodus? Why'd you bring us out here to die? He meant to the first time. And then you escape narrowly by the miraculous water out of a rock, but this time he's got you. It's not thinking at all. And why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us to this wretched place? It's funny how often they say that. Oh, Egypt, remember Egypt? Those were good days. You were slaves! You were slaves in Egypt! Yeah, but they had onions back there.
And bricks without straw.
Bricks without straw. Double your productivity with half as much straw. And oh yeah, you can get beaten for not doing your job. But oh man, I loved Egypt. Those were good days. Why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us into this wretched place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there water to drink. Then Moses and Aaron came in from the presence of the assembly to the doorway of the tent of meeting, and they fell on their faces. And then the glory of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the rod. Now, where is the rod at this moment? It's sitting in front of the testimony, sitting right in there with the Ark of the Covenant. That's how holy this stick is ever since it came back to life and became a type of Christ. And it sits right in there by the Ark of the Covenant. And so God says to Moses, go get the rod. It's the same rod. So go get the rod. And you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes that it may yield its water. What's different this time?
Speak to it.
Speak. Don't hit it. The rock only needs to be struck once. Once the rock is struck, the living water flows. To get the living water flowing again, you speak to the rock. You don't strike it again. It's been struck. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, that means in the tabernacle, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock. And he said to them, listen now, you rebels. Yeah, you can hear it, can't you? Moses is mad. Moses has had enough. And by the way, haven't we seen that continually? How often has Moses gone to God and said, what am I going to do with these people? Several times he goes to God and says, what do you want from me?
Kill me now.
Kill me now. He says that a couple of occasions. Just kill me. These are your people, not mine. What am I supposed to do with these people? And so now he's gone out there. This is why I stressed that they're complaining again in the same place about the same thing. You can imagine Moses' frustration. Now, by the way, one thing that we know about Moses is that he is called the meekest of men. But that word meek has moved in its meaning through all these years until it's reached our 21st century notion of meekness. That means kind of docile and kind of milquetoast. It's not what it means at all. It was a word that means constrained, a man who's held in place. Moses didn't lose his temper. Well, he's going to lose his temper. He didn't lose his temperament. He was still fully, completely Moses. This is the same Moses who got thrown out of Egypt, though he was a prince, at 40 years of age for killing one of the slave drivers and then hiding the body in the sand and then running for it. That Moses, the angry Moses, the fighting Moses. This is a guy with a temper. And now he's a guy with a temper under the hand of a sovereign who is controlling him, temper and all, to accomplish God's ultimate will. And here's Moses letting his temper get the best of him. And look at what he does. He said to them, "Listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" Did God say to say anything like that? No. No, here's Moses mouthing off. "What do you want from us? You want me to bring water out of the rock again? Is that what you want from us?" You can hear it. He's just angry with these people. And he's mocking these people. And he's tired of these people. And Moses lifted up his hand and he struck the rock a second time with the rod. Big mistake. For that, he doesn't get to go to the promised land. That's the one that did it. Through everything that Moses has done, through everything that Moses has done in his dealings with God and his dealings with Israel, this is the one. Why that? Why that? Moses has had temper tantrums before. He's gone up on the mountain and had temper tantrums with God. This is the same Moses who got tablets of stone from God with God's handwriting on them. And the stones themselves had been cut out with the finger of God. Moses takes them down off the mountain, sees the golden calf, breaks the stones. You would think of all the things to take care of. You would take care of the handwritten rocks that God just handed you. But in his temperament, in his temper, he breaks the rocks. Now, God used Moses' temper in breaking the first set of commandments to teach a lesson. Because then Moses has to go back up in front of God and go, I broke those. And God says, okay, we're going to do it again, but here's how we're going to do it. This time, you cut out the rocks. Then I'll write on them. So the first covenant of perfect law from God was broken immediately because as soon as he gets down off the mountain, the children of Israel are already rebelling and already dancing naked around a calf. And so the first law is broken instantly. The second law is cut out with a man's hands, but written with the finger of God. It's a type of Christ who came as a man and yet was written as the finger of God. That covenant was kept and put inside a golden box, kept intact, perfectly under the Kippurith, the golden seat of mercy. So now, God does it again with Moses. Okay, we're going to do a type together here, Moses. Here's the rock, here's the rod. Use the rod to strike the rock, out's going to come living water. Now, the second time we do it, speak to that rock, and water will come forward. Moses messes up the type completely, strikes the rock a second time, which would say that every time you need mercy from Christ, he has to be crucified again. Now, the writer of Hebrews picks up that very idea and says that if the first sacrifice of Christ was not sufficient to save people utterly and completely, if it wasn't sufficient to perfect the people who he died for, then if those people could fall away, it would be impossible to renew them again to repentance because the first one didn't work. So you can't take them back to that first one. That first one didn't save them and didn't keep them. He says instead, you would have to crucify Christ afresh and lay the cross to an open shame. And so that's the same typology here that's being destroyed by Moses hitting the rock a second time. Now, here comes the big theological part of the evening, as if that wasn't theological enough. Within theological circles, there is a word called compatibilism. If you're a member of GCA, you've heard that word before. People struggle with the notion of an absolutely sovereign God and the existence of sin in a universe created by an infinitely right and holy and good God. And so there seems to be some kind of conflict there. They say, well, how can a righteous, holy, infinitely good God, in his absolute sovereignty, also bring about the existence of sin and rebellion in his own universe? How did that happen and why did it happen? And I won't get into, obviously, all the philosophical answers to that question tonight outside of saying that people try to create a tension between sin and God's holiness, or man's rebellion and God's sovereignty. And they say, well, if God is absolutely sovereign, then how do men keep getting away with rebelling? Why is there rebellion in the universe of a sovereign God? And the answer is, because the rebellion serves the ultimate purpose of the absolutely sovereign God. That's called compatibilism. Now, we see examples of compatibilism all the way through the Bible. I'll give you a couple of my favorite, most obvious examples. Joseph and his brothers are in Egypt. And when they have to bow down in front of Joseph and they recognize that this is the younger brother that they sold into slavery and told dad he was dead, and they're expecting him then to put them in prison or whatever else, because he's second only to Pharaoh. He can do whatever he wants. He can say off with their heads and they're all finished. And instead, Joseph says to them, you did mean it for evil, but God meant it for good, to save many people alive. In other words, you put me in that pit because you're evil, but God put me in that pit so I'd be here to keep you alive because you are the descendants of Abraham. So God is keeping his promise to Abraham through you, though you're evil. And the thing you did that was evil, God used for good. That's compatibilism. The most obvious example of compatibilism is the fact that Peter says it on the day of Pentecost. The Jews and the Gentiles and Herod and Pilate gathered together against Christ to do whatever God's hand had appointed to be done. And in so doing, they did the absolute worst thing human beings have ever done. They killed the Prince of Life. It doesn't get worse than that. And in so doing, God delivered, saved, and redeemed all his people. It's a horrible thing that happened that evil men did. And Peter identifies them as wicked men and says, you with wicked hands have slain the Prince of Life. You're wicked. And in so doing, God saved all his people. It's this remarkable compatibilism. Okay, so now Moses has messed up the type of Christ. Moses struck the rock a second time, messed it all up. The result of that is going to be that Moses doesn't get to go into the promised land. Now, Moses throughout the Bible is the type of the law. He is the embodiment of the law. The Old Testament is referred to in New Testament times, the collective Old Testament is referred to as the law and the prophets. We know that phrase, the law and the prophets. Whenever you hear that good old Hebraism, the law and the prophets, you know that that's a reference to what we call the Old Testament. All of the Jewish scripture, the law and the prophets. When Jesus was on the Mount of Transfiguration, he was flanked by Moses and Elijah. Moses, the law, Elijah, the chief prophet. Peter tried to equate the three. A typical theological error that people still try to make today, where they see no distinction between the Old and New Covenants and say, well, now there's Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. They're all prophets of God and they're all equal, and they try to flatten the plane between the three. Peter tried to do that. So then God took the other two away, and when Peter looked up, there was only Jesus, and the voice from heaven said, this is my beloved Son, hear him. And the law and the prophets are out of the way. Now, if Moses had led the children of Israel into the land that was promised to Abraham by faith, then you have
the law as a means of salvation.
You have the law as a means of God keeping his promises by faith. So in incredible compatibilism, Moses messes up the type of Christ. For that, God says, you don't get to see the promised land. Then God is going to pick a new leader who is going to lead the children of Israel into the promised land. Who is he?
Joshua.
Joshua. Whose name means?
Jesus.
It's the same, yeah. God saves, Jehovah Yeshua, the God that saves. And then The angel Gabriel comes to this little teenage girl in Nazareth and says, you're going to bear a child. And the thing that's in you is going to be called the Son of the Most High. And you will call his name Yeshua. Not Dave, not Doug, not Ralph. All good Hebrew names. No, you're going to call him Yeshua. That's no mistake. He's going to have the exact same name as the leader who does lead the children of Israel into the promised land, because the types are going to connect again. So Moses messes up the type, and we would say, terrible, awful. Moses' temper got the best of him. What a terrible thing to do. What if he hadn't? What if he hadn't and continued to lead the children of Israel right to the promised land? Well, there was no way that was going to happen. That was never, never going to happen. Because in God's grand economy, the promise made to Abraham was a promise made by faith. And it wasn't going to be completed by the law. In fact, writing to the Galatians, Paul picks it up and says that the law that was introduced 430 years after the Abrahamic covenant did not annul that covenant, even though it came and left. Because that covenant was by faith, and the law was by works of the flesh, which never saved anybody. So the law was introduced, the law was taken away, but the Abrahamic covenant of salvation by grace through faith continued on. And so it had to be Yeshua that leads to the promises of God. It can't be the law. How did God work that out? God used the nature and the character and the temperament of Moses to condemn Moses, to make sure Moses didn't mess up the grander typology of Christ and the grander scheme of God. See, sometimes, let me bring this down to brass tacks. I'll show you what I mean. Sometimes I stand up here and preach, and when I get done, I think to myself, well, that's about as good as I ever do. And I'm my own worst critic. I'm very hard on myself. Jennifer will tell you, I frequently call Jeff on a Sunday afternoon and go, did that make any sense? Sometimes I get done and I go, okay, that seemed pretty clear. That went pretty well. Other times I get done and I can't wait to get home so that I can beat myself around the head and chest area and beat my breast and cry out to God and say, that was not good. What is wrong with me? I get very mad at myself when I feel like I didn't treat God's word on the level I should have treated it. And yet, almost invariably, when I'm at my worst, somebody will call me or email me or catch me the next week and say, you have no idea how much that meant to me. Oh, that message just spoke to my heart. And I think, oh, that's right, Jim. That's right, Jim. It's not about you. Just stay out of the way. God's doing his thing. God's talking to his people. God is accomplishing his will despite me. And sometimes he has to let me flounder, and sometimes he has to crush my ego again to keep me out of the way so that he can work with his people. And when I'm at my worst, oh, God's at his best. Paul said that. Paul said, when I'm at my weakest, then is Christ strong in me. Well, that's the same thing that happened with Moses. Moses had to be crushed because all the people were looking to him as if he was God. All the people were looking to Moses and saying, you, Moses, you, why did you bring us here? Why did you do this? And then he got up in his ego and said, what do you want? You want me to bring water from a rock? And he did that head motion. He got up there and said, you want me to do this for you? He personalized it. He made it about himself. You want me to be your leader? You want me to bring you water from a rock? God said, okay, time to crush you. Time to take you back down. These are my people. These aren't your people. And by the way, you're the law. And the law can only condemn. I'm going to bring my people into their promise by grace.
How condemning he was is right there.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Every disobedience receives a recompense and reward.
a recompense of reward. Isn't that the truth? So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock. And he said to them, "Listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock a second time with his rod, and the water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and the beast drank. By the way, notice God was faithful. God gave water to his people. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." Look how personal God took this one. I mean, all he did was strike the rock a second time, and God said, "You haven't believed me, number one. I told you what to do, and you didn't do it. You didn't believe me." Apparently, Moses didn't believe that just talking to the rock was sufficient. Apparently, he thought he had to strike the rock. In other words, let me apply this too. In other words, when we say to people, Christ is sufficient, Christ is enough, Christ is fully and completely able to save you, sometimes people don't believe that because their ego gets in the way and they say, "Yeah, but I got to add something. I got to put some of me in there. I got to have my flesh. I got to exercise myself, my will, my decision. I got to add something." Moses was told, "Go talk to the rock." And Moses said, "No, I got to add something. I got to add some me. I got to add some of my flesh, my works. And I even got to tell the people, this is me. You want me to bring you water? And then I got to do something so that when I do it, people go, 'Ooh, Moses did that.' And then we got water." What God wanted the people to see was, this rock has been smitten. Just talk to the rock. Talk to the rock and water's going to flow. Life is going to flow to you. Just talk to the rock. And they didn't believe that. That just seemed too easy. I've had people say to me before, when I have said to them, "All you got to do is believe. Just trust completely. Throw yourself out into eternity on the bare thread of the promise that Christ is enough." And people say to me, "Oh, that's too easy. I got to add some me. There's got to be some me in there somewhere, isn't there, Jim? Don't I do something? I say a sinner's prayer or march around the building 7 times? Don't I have to do something? Right. Come to the front and cry through a box of Kleenex to show I really mean it? Don't I have to do something?" No, just believe, just believe. Of course, the irony is, right about the time people say, "That's easy," I say, "Fine, do it." You think it's easy? You really think it's that easy to put your flesh aside and just believe? Yeah, go ahead, knock yourself out. So let's wrap this up. You didn't believe me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel. By the way, in what way did he not treat God as holy? Didn't obey his word. Boy, you are good, Gladys. You are on the money tonight. Yeah, didn't obey his word. "Here's my word. There's my word. I don't believe your word." Well, then you don't see me as holy.
The failure of the law. Disobedience.
Yeah. So you didn't treat me as holy before the sons of Israel. Therefore, you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. Those were the waters of Meribah, quarreling, because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself holy among them. He kept his word. He gave them the water. He was faithful. But the people, faithless yet again. From Kadesh, Moses then sent messengers to the king of Edom and said, "Thus your brother Israel has said, 'You know all the hardships that have befallen us, that our fathers went down to Egypt, and we stayed in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians treated our fathers badly. But when we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out from Egypt. And behold, we are at Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land, and we shall not pass through any field or any vineyard. We shall not even drink water from the well.'" How could he promise that, by the way?
Because they had a rock.
Yeah, we have a rock. We take this rock with us. "We won't even drink from your wells. We shall go along the king's highway, not turning to the right or the left. until we pass through your territory. Edom, however, said to him, you shall not pass through us, lest I come out with the sword against you. Again, the sons of Israel said to him, we shall go up by the highway, and if I and my livestock do drink any of your water, then I'll pay its price. Let me only pass through on my feet, nothing else. But Edom said to him, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him with a heavy force and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory, so Israel turned away from him. Now when they set out from Kadesh, the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to Mount Hor. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron at Mount Hor by the border of the land of Edom, saying, and that's where we'll pick up next week. It's a cliffhanger. Now this is where he's going to tell Aaron, and you're going to die too. The next thing, the next big section is going to be passing on the high priesthood to Aaron's eldest son, and Aaron being told that he doesn't get to lead him in either. So Moses and Aaron, the two brothers who led the children of Israel out of Egypt, who were the only two who were allowed to go up on the mountain and see God, the ones who had the law, those two God's going to set aside, and he's going to have Joshua lead the children of Israel, and he's going to give them a new high priest, the second generation. How often have we seen this? We keep seeing this over and over again. It's always the second generation that receives the promises, the same way that it's the new covenant, the second covenant, that accomplishes the promises of God. See how that all ties together?
Is that the point of the symbolism between the youngest always getting it, or that just God, you know, is in control and can just choose the younger one even though everyone expects it to be?
In some instances, like in Isaac shall thy seed be called, or Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, it's God choosing, and Paul says so when he picks that up in Romans 9 and uses that as evidence, and even says it was done that way so that God's purpose according to election would stand. So Paul uses it as evidence of election. But it's also so consistent that we see it typologically pointing to the newer, better, higher covenant, which is the second one, which is the new one. Yeah.
And you know, because what he's doing is waving this tapestry. And you don't keep messing up the picture. You put the red thread in the wrong place.
That's right. And that's exactly what we saw tonight. God weaving his tapestry, and somebody messed up the design. And they paid a heavy price for it. But then in God's remarkable compatibilism, the price he paid served God's tapestry to tell the consistent story. So what are you going to take away from this? Well,
smart.
God is smart and he does things his way. Okay, if you come away with that, I'm good with that. See, here's the point. Sometimes you're going to mess up. Sometimes you're going to end up saying, man, I don't know how God could love me now. I have no idea how God could accept me now. And I really blew it. Well, see, the God we're dealing with, the absolutely sovereign, to use that word again, compatibilistic God, knew you were going to do that before you did it, knew that was what you were like when he chose to save you, sent his son to redeem you because you're like that, and uses even the worst of your character to glorify himself, because he gets the greatest glory out of saving the worst sinners. And so I'm not saying go sin all the more. That's what some people thought Paul was saying. So he had to confront that and say, well, then are we supposed to sin all the more that grace may abound? Well, heaven forbid. Then he goes on to say, no, we mortify the deeds of our flesh because we understand that we've been saved. But at the same time, don't ever get the idea, don't ever get the sense that because you're you, you can be so you that you can destroy the plan of God. God has a long, rich history of dealing with rebels and consistently keeping his plan anyway. He did still bring the water, but he did also use Moses' temper and mistake to weave another story of how the law could not fulfill the promises of faith. So you're dealing with a real smart God who knows you're like this, and he's fully capable of taking care of you when you're at your worst.
And he'll correct
you. Yeah, I tell folks, this is it's only 8 o'clock, so I've got 2 more minutes I can use here. When my kids were little, and this is a mistake that all humans make, when my kids were little, if they got in trouble, and I said, "Who broke this?" And they would scatter like cockroaches when the kitchen light goes on, you know? I don't have cockroaches in my kitchen when the lights go on, but you get the image. And so they would run for it, especially if I said, "Get in here." Where would they go?
Far away.
As far away as they could get. Take off. That is the natural human response. When we know that we've sinned, when we know that we've fallen, when we know that we've really made a mess, and we know that God knows it, the tendency is to want to run away.
Adam.
Hiding, running, get away. That's the human tendency. Well, one day, I forget it, I think it was James who figured it out first, who's too big to do this now. Mm-mm. But it was James who figured out that if I was going to spank him, the best thing he could do was cling to my leg.
Yeah. Oh, I remember the story.
Yeah.
He would hold on to my leg.
Yeah.
Instead of running away, he got as close as he could to me. Now, that does a couple things. Number one, when he would look up at me with those big tear-filled blue puppy dog eyes, "Sorry, Daddy." Well, it's much harder to get mad, you know, this little moppet holding onto your leg. Sorry. Whereas, you know, if he's got to run, then I got to catch him, and by the time I catch him, I'm more angry that I had to run. And if I'm running toward him, I can get a good swing at him going by. But, you know, he figured out that if he was right here, you can't get a good swing. You can't. And so I would always tell my children, if you're in trouble, get close. Press close. If your problem is between you and me, come to me. And we'll solve it together. We'll get through it together. Come to the one who loves you, and you'll be okay. If you run away from the one who loves you, well, then you're much more likely to have to be corrected. And God, like a loving father, will correct you. The writer of Hebrews says it. And so I encourage people all the time, yeah, you're going to make a mess of things. You're going to goof up. You're going to sin. You're going to rebel. You're going to do stuff that you can't believe is you. Very much like what we read Sunday morning. So when you do, go back to the one that loves you. Go talk to the rock. Go back and talk, and the living water flows. And let him know that you know that that's not the way you meant to be, because he knew you were like that to start with, and he loved you anyway. I love Jeremiah 31:3. I have loved you with an everlasting love, and therefore with loving kindness I have drawn you. That's the God you're dealing with. And that's the God who has given you all of this history to prove to you that he's like that. And all he wants now is for you to respond by believing him and holding him up as holy. Do that. You can save yourself a lot of trouble. I wish I had figured that out when I was much, much younger. I decided I would learn the hard way. But you can save yourself a lot of trouble. Any questions about that? Isn't that a good section of the Book of Numbers?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
People go, "Book of Numbers? Why are you teaching the Book of Numbers?" And they say it in that tone of voice, too. Can we do something more interesting?
Please. Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.